is the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Recording in progress.
So if you were present, either in person or online on Sunday, during the very moving ordination ceremony, you, like me, heard many, many words. Buddha's teachings, his questions, the instructions, the incantations, and the vows. Some we heard very loud, repeated in unison. Yes, I will! Others arose in beautiful Dharma clouds flowing through us in the sanctuary for about 2 hours. So tonight, as a way to begin the seminar, I wanted to read two of the beautiful opening paragraphs of the ceremony and a few other words from it, which may have flown by in that exciting flow of events. You have come here to be ordained as a disciple of the Buddha. Listen attentively. Due to the coming together of auspicious circumstances in your present life, this ceremony has been made possible. As Buddha's disciple, you have the opportunity to receive the teachings transmitted from Shakyamuni Buddha through the ancestors to us, and to manifest the Buddha's way forever. Even the Buddhas and ancestors cannot but admire you who are earnestly seeking the Buddha's path in this world, with sincere belief in the Dharma and practicing your way with thoughtful consideration for all sentient beings. I actually think we can all see that and hear that as something for us. To receive a human body in this cosmic world is a rare occurrence. Yet, we cannot avoid the reality of birth and death. We must deeply and gratefully appreciate how meaningful and marvelous is this present existence. Rare also is the opportunity to listen to the Buddha, and the appearance of Buddha in this world is our greatest joy. Embracing the Buddha's teaching moment after moment, we endeavor to live the life of enlightenment, setting aside greed, letting go of anger, transcending self-delusion. Please reflect on the causes and conditions that have made this ceremony possible. Consider the immeasurable blessings of your family and friends. Strive to return at least a small part of these miraculous gifts, and with your life, express your gratitude to all those who have cared so much for you now and in the past. So each ordinee was then given a rakasu, an okesa, eating bowls, and a Dharma name, and asked to practice with the mind and body of their sacred meaning. Then they were told, you have returned to your original nature, free from attachment and limited ways. From now on, enlightenment is your teacher. Buddha is your teacher. All beings are your teachers. Do not be distracted from the fundamental way. This is the path of mercy for all existence, all things. O good disciple of Buddha, from now on, and even after realizing Buddhahood, will you follow this compassionate path of the three treasures that we have passed on to you? Yes, yes, I will. Finally, they received the three precepts, the 10 grave precepts, lineage papers, and the women's heritage document. And as the ceremony ended, their pathways as priests opened up. Norman asked them to speak tonight with two questions in mind. What do you find most compelling, personally about the Dharma that makes you want to commit yourself to a lifetime of practice? And what makes you feel that you want to do that as a priest? What has brought them to this place of leaving home? What are their reflections and thoughts about the changes and decisions in their lives now? We'll hear from each one in a short talk. And as I said, we'll then open it up in person and online to ask questions and perhaps share what this ordination event has meant to us. So many of us were moved, and so much happened there that day. So let us begin now with Ann Johnson, who I will introduce briefly. Onshin Daiji, profound gift, great healing. Ann and her husband, Scott, raised three daughters in a small town in Wisconsin. Sorry, just seeing you makes me cry a little bit. And they now have three granddaughters who they cherish and love. Her career was spent working as a licensed clinical social worker with children and families. Decades ago, she says, she published two books. One was The Essence of Parenting, and then another is called Return to the Sea, Reflections on Anne Morrow Lindbergh's book, Gift from the Sea. She said, I have been practicing with Everyday Zen since 2015. I remember she started doing the translations for us. It was really such a devotion. And then she completed the Buddhist chaplaincy program at Upaya in 2021. And now she's a sewing teacher for a number of sanghas in Wisconsin and currently serving as shuso for the Open Door Zen community in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you, Anne. Beautiful to see you.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to begin tonight by...
Can you see her? Yeah. Good, okay.
I want to get out of... I want to get into gallery view. That's better. Great. So I want to begin tonight by, of course, offering my deep gratitude to our teacher, Norman, and to all of you in the Everyday Sangha. I'd also like to dedicate the merits of my talk to a dear friend, Dharma sister, and teacher, Suzanne Kilkus, who you all have been chanting for many, many years. She has a serious blood cancer that has kind of returned full strength, and so my heart is with her. For when the mind, with irreversible intent, embraces bodhicitta, willing to set free the endless multitude of beings, at that instant, from that moment on, there arises a great and unremitting stream, a strength of wholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, equal to the vastness of the sky. That's from the way of the Bodhisattva. As many of you know, it was the death of my eldest daughter, Hannah, 13 years ago that put me on this path. I was 54 years old at the time and had always been a very religious person, devoted to one spiritual path or another. But when Hannah died, my heart was shattered and nothing could touch the bottomless feeling of loss, pain, and confusion that flooded my being. A few months after Hannah's death, I was given Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart. And that led me to a retreat entitled Facing Our Dying that was led by Flint Sparks, then a novice Soto Zen priest in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. When I heard Flint share the Dharma, I knew I had found what I was looking for, not just since Hannah's death, but my whole life. As John mentioned, I'm currently shuso for one of Flint's sanghas, the Open Doors and Community in Madison, Wisconsin. At our spring retreat this past April, we immersed ourselves in the Heart Sutra. Flint's husband, Aaron, had died, but a few months prior, he had Lewy body's disease. In the first talk of the retreat, Flint shared his reflections on the Heart Sutra, including his own expression of the first few lines and a new title for it, the Broken Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken, when shattered by profound loss, realizes that nothing makes sense anymore, that a body, a heart, and a mind do not mean what they used to. And through this unending suffering, is relieved of all illusions. I would say Flint's rendition of the Broken Heart Sutra pretty much sums up the compelling power of the Dharma that drew me to it. The Dharma has the capacity to transform suffering into wakefulness and wakefulness into compassion. Since I was a young girl, I felt the call to ordain, but I was raised Catholic, so that wasn't an option. Once exposed to the Dharma, that call was reignited, but I had no idea how to become a Zen priest. So I Googled how to become a Zen priest, and I found a talk by someone by the name of Norman Fisher. I found the Everyday Zen website. On it, I found Norman's study guide. I began methodically working my way through it. I was insatiable. I knew I had found my teacher. In 2017, shortly after I received Jukai from Norman, the teacher at the Milwaukee Zen Center, where I was Zen practicing, asked me to be their sewing teacher. I really had no idea what I was doing, but I said yes. Sewing is such good practice, such good, good practice. Shortly after becoming a sewing teacher, I began asking Norman about ordination, but I wasn't ready to leave my family to do monastic training. So I came up with the idea that maybe training as a Buddhist chaplain would satisfy the call I felt to serve as a priest. So I enrolled in Upaya's Buddhist chaplaincy program. I completed the program with the exception of turning in my final thesis. I was a licensed clinical social worker at the time and had chosen to write on the topic, how Buddhist forms and rituals can help heal inherited family trauma. I did the research and wrote most of the paper, but in the end, I couldn't put my name on it and turn it in. Deep inside, I knew I was simply writing about concepts I'd read about, not something that was yet my lived experience. The desire to ordain persisted. On New Year's Eve 2019, during the pandemic, I was rocking my five-month-old granddaughter to sleep when my son-in-law came into the room and took her from me, telling me I needed to quickly go talk to my daughter. She was walking out the door, heading to the emergency room with my husband, who was experiencing chest pain. Once they were on their way, I went back into the darkened bedroom and held the baby in my arms. I began rocking the both of us. Instantly, I was filled with the awareness that I had not even begun to fully face the great matter. I was still terrified of death. I was nowhere near ready to ordain. And I definitely was still not ready to leave my family to do monastic training. Ironically, without knowing what was transpiring in my life just then, the day my husband was released from the hospital after having two heart stents put in, Norman sent me an email saying two women at Everyday Zen were preparing to ordain and I could become part of their cohort. How could I say no? And yet, I knew I wasn't ready, but this was my chance. What I had wanted and waited for so long. So I said yes. I was a member of the Zen Buddhist Sewing Teachers Council at the time, helping organize a 6-month online sewing teachers practice period. I told Norman I wanted to wait until I completed the practice period before starting to sew my okesa. About 2 months into the sewing practice period, I knew again I was not ready to ordain. I knew it mainly in my body, and I was compelled to listen. With my head hung low in embarrassment, I went to Norman and told him I wasn't ready for what he was so generously willing to offer me, nor did I know if I would ever be ready. Gradually, I became the sewing teacher for a number of sanghas in the Midwest. I had found my place. I felt great relief that I hadn't ordained. In the ensuing years, both my mother and mother-in-law had needed my assistance as they aged and died. My husband had several serious health scares, and I was grateful I had been at his side each time they occurred, so I was able to quickly get him to the emergency room. My daughter had a second baby, and I was available to help. And then in 2024, I began having eye issues. I have something called senile entropia. My eyelids turn under, causing my lashes to scratch my cornea. In 2024, I had to have surgery on both lower eyelids. Less than a year later, I had to have a more extensive surgery on both lower eyelids. I started to wonder how long I would be able to serve in the capacity of sewing teacher. I began to ask myself, if I cannot serve as a sewing teacher, how might I serve? It was 2025, and Norman gave a talk on the road check during practice period. He noted that the last line of the chant, Kodo Shoshu Jo, that we translate as saving all beings, is a bit ambiguous, and he asked, does it mean that when we put on the robe, we are affirming our commitment to save all beings? Or expressing again our commitment to save all beings? Or does it mean that when we put on the robe, we are, by doing that, saving all beings? And then he answered his own question. Well, Norman said, I have always thought that it must be the latter. I think the verse means that when we put on the robe, we are, by doing that, saving all beings. The whole idea of being liberated from self, of honoring the form of the robe as being beyond appearances, and living our life as the field of blessing, is to see that our separateness has always been, from the beginning, impossible and impossibly false. To see that there never has been any other way for a human being to live than this way. So when we put on the robe in that moment of our chanting, our hearts are pure and everything is put right. In that moment, everything is at peace. Everything is loved and respected in that moment. All beings are free. And I knew in that moment that if my eyes failed, if my mind failed, if my body failed, this I could still do. I could still rise each morning, put the okesa on my head, and chant the verse of the robe for all beings. I was stunned that the call to ordain had come forward again. Did I dare ask the Norman again? Or was this just my crazy ego asserting itself? On the heels of that talk by Norman came the talk of our dear Shuso that year, Laura Trippi. She quoted one of her early teachers, Chogyam Rinpoche. See clearly, act decisively, know what is. There was no escaping this time. I wrote to Norman and asked if I might ordain, and his answer was yes. I'm still not sure why I'm ordaining as a priest, but I do know that it has something to do with the words of Dogen Norman wrote on the back of our priest Rakasus. What can I accomplish? Though not a Buddha, let my priest's body be a raft to carry others across. And I do know that I am not doing this alone. I'm doing it because of, with, and for each one of you, just as you are practicing and expressing the Dharma as you, because of, with, and for me. I'd like to end my talk with a poem from the first free women. Rest, my heart, wrapped in these robes you sewed yourself. Like pots of herbs left cooking overnight, that which was boiling away has boiled away. That which was on fire has all turned to ash. Thank you for listening to my talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to ring the bell just for a moment of acknowledgement. And thank you. Our next priest to come up next here is Pearl, Pearl Khan, Honsho Mitsukyo, original voice, intimate abode. Pearl grew up in Queens, New York. She said her favorite childhood activities were reading and rearranging little toy figurines, walking around, people watching on the subway also. Her family is from Taiwan, so she says there's Buddhism in her background, but her parents would not have called themselves Buddhists. She attended a secular all-girls school in Manhattan and studied comparative literature at the University of Chicago, then spent a year living in Kingston, Jamaica on a Fulbright scholarship, studying Chinese diaspora before enrolling in law school at UC Davis. She started to practice environmental law in rural California at a legal aid organization where she met Nick. On their first date, they ate sandwiches and talked about Vipassana practice. She eventually transitioned into private practice where she had the opportunity to work alongside Richard Taylor and also worked in-house for a public open space district based in Los Altos. Pearl, please come up and give your talk. Do you want me to take this off? Thank you.
These words are for Jean, who teaches me with her beauty. What compels me most about the Dharma is the beauty of it. By beauty, I don't mean pretty. Beauty is paying attention, catching a glimpse of a pelican low against the sea. Maybe it's looking at me too. Hearing the ocean, being heard, it's mutual. During session a few weeks ago, I listened to the occasional creaking of the stairs. The whole world is singing a quiet song. In Norman's Escape This Crazy Life of Tears, his poetry book about the pilgrimage he made to Japan in 2010 with many of you, he writes, "I choose beauty since you can have only one." This suggests to me beauty is including everything into one path. Nothing is left out. We've been reading Mel Weitzman's Seeing One Thing Through, and this passage about Suzuki Roshi spoke to me. Every day, he, Suzuki Roshi, did the same thing, which was amazing to me. I had never seen anyone do that kind of an activity before. His life was devoted to sitting zazen, bowing, lighting incense, and the various other things that he did. When there were so many other things to do in the world, here was this person simply doing these things over and over again, every day. I never thought of myself doing anything like that in what seemed like such a narrowly disciplined way of life. I was impressed by this. I think this is the beauty that I'm talking about. In doing our practice over and over again, I can feel the largeness that is within and around stones, trees, children. By sitting zazen every day, attending seminar on Wednesday nights, going to an all-day sit once a month, my life opens up and it welcomes me. I really do feel that little by little, my practice for myself and our together practice for everything and everyone shows me how bright things really are. Even the dim and muffled moments have a bright quality to them. I studied the precepts with Sue a couple of years ago. Before Jukai, Sue printed out the writing I had sent her as responses to each precept and had them spiral bound into a little book. Sue offered a line from Dogen as an epigraph to my responses. Xuanzha said, "The entire world of the 10 directions is one bright pearl. What do you do with your understanding?" That Xuanzha said these words and that Dogen recorded them, that Sue came across these words, read them, and passed them along to me to consider. This rich thread of generous continuity really encourages me to avail myself to the spirit of repetition, to take seriously my commitments, to show up and traverse this subtle given form together, maybe even slipping into the stream of compassion, and to live the questions. In our Tokudo ceremonies, we say the path of mercy. My personal version of this is the path of beauty. The beauty way compels me. What makes you feel that you want to do that as a priest? Great robe of liberation. It's not so much belief. It's being moved by the possibility that we can really let go. Moved by the possibility that we can really keep on going no matter what. Moved by the total willingness of Norman to be here with us. And I really am moved to the point of taking little quiet half steps around the room of my life again and again. It's the mercy of this practice that moved me to sow an okesa. It's a complete joy for me to practice. I owe so much to everyone who has kept the practice going, kept it alive through generations, keep it alive today. Maybe I can do my part to keep it going too. And the reason I want to keep it going is because of this happiness I really feel. Maybe someone will trip upon the practice one day at a time when they really need it, like I did, and it will light up their life like it did mine. A brightness that's right there for everyone. I didn't know I was going to ask to ordain until I did. And it felt like the question came straight from my gut. I felt that I wanted to give something up and give something away. Maybe I feel that sewing the robe and wearing it is my way of saying thank you. Thank you for this life. A line from the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi comes to mind. In truth, it is you. That's how I feel about ordaining. In truth, it is you. This powerful, kind Sangha. Whenever I feel sad or fearful, I entrust myself to our Sangha, and immediately I feel revived. Speaking of saying thank you, I want to say thank you to my family in Asia. I don't have the chance to see them or talk to them often, but they're deep in my heart and I think about them a lot. From a young age, they infuse my life with a deep love and appreciation for relationships. Although I read and write in English, it hasn't entirely displaced my Mandarin. Maybe this is why I write poetry. It's my meeting place for the languages that I've been given. Maybe this is why I want to be a priest, to be a meeting place for myself. So here's a poem from my dad, who flew out from New York to attend our ordination and kept Noemi occupied during the ceremony. And a poem for my mom, who gave birth in a foreign place and moved again across the country to again care for me. So a poem for my whole family, who sometimes speaks in another language. This poem is by Robert Creeley. It's called The Language. Locate, I love you, somewhere in teeth and eyes. Bite it, but take care not to hurt. You want so much, so little. Words say everything. I love you again. Then what is emptiness for? To fill, fill. I heard words and words full of holes, aching. Speech is a mouth. I want to end by saying thank you to Nick. Thank you for always buying me new clothes to wear, for reminding me not to eat junk food, for sharing the music of your life with me, for being willing to do that. I'm so grateful for our together practice. Thank you for listening to these words.
next speaker is Lini, Daikan Tokure, Great Intuition, Devoted Effort. Lini grew up in Washington, D.C. and also in the New York metro area. She spent 11 years in the Bay Area and also lived for some time in Berlin. She is a research professor at the University of Vermont, whose expertise is in climate change mitigation, land use, social inclusion, food systems, and sustainable agriculture. She received both her Bachelor's of Science degree and her PhD at UC Berkeley in natural resource management. She's worked internationally for decades, primarily in Asia, especially in Indonesian Borneo, where she also lived for 13 years. She began studying Zen formally 21 years ago, and she has a 30-year-old son. So come talk to us, please, Lini. Oops. Tethered.
Those are two tough talks to follow. Thank you to everybody. Thank you to my dear Dharma sisters. Thank you to every member of the Sangha whose heart I've had a chance to sample here and there through various trips. And I'm always overwhelmed by the generosity that I feel here. So I landed in Vermont after those 13 years in Asia with a mother who had been diagnosed with cancer the day I arrived, my precious 10-year-old son, and returning to the East Coast where I had escaped, actually, to California and Asia because of just family dynamics and some college trauma. And I landed 5 minutes away from the Vermont Zen Center. And in one of my first Doksans, the teacher said, "You just do it." One of my first questions was, "What is presence?" Everybody was talking about being present. And I asked her, what do I do? And I expected it to be some long, complicated, decades-long effort. And she said, "You just do it." So I spent the next day like a light switch. Presence. And I realized there was a difference. There was a way I could live with that presence. And that made all the difference. So I live in my head, as Jean was describing. I have a job that requires a lot of intellectual debate, and I enjoy intellectual debate. And growing up, I learned about God as paintings and churches, and I learned about morality as rules, and it was all very much conceptual. I'm still not used to this. And I guess what my practice in those first few weeks, even in Vermont, showed me was that there was something I could feel. You know, when I sat, I remember one day going, "Whoa, you know, this is real. This isn't religion. This is real." And that, more than anything else, that presence and being able to feel in my body this practice, and everything then that flows from that is what has compelled me to follow this practice. And as I was preparing this talk, I realized if I could trace as a tree everything I've learned in the last 20 years, it comes back to that simple act of just doing it. And my screensaver comes on too often. So I marveled at this world where I could suddenly feel less anxious, where I could feel things, energy moving in ways that hadn't moved before, and become more deeply aware of new dimensions of my life and other people's life and my relationship with them. And it brought an aliveness that I could palpably feel. So what do I find so compelling about all of that? I think it's the immediacy. You know, I think about Manjushri's sword and that precision of the moment that we're able to cut through delusion, even if it's still with my ragged, difficult breath, you know, that I can be with my breath and start to have that immediacy. I think it's also obviously, you know, something our Zen literature shows us in a less dramatic way, Ryokan's poems. Please don't question me about illusion and enlightenment. This old fellow just likes to smile to himself. I wade across streams with bony legs and carry a bag about in fine spring weather. That's my life, and the world owes me nothing. I'm in love with the depth and the mystery of presence and how it has slowly, mostly gently, nudged me in ways that seem good for me and others. How presence actualizes the precepts for me and the paramitas, which I love even more than our precepts, in a way that I also can feel. How it allows me to be more caring and patient in my relationships with my friends and family, because I can now connect. I can actually feel a connection and notice their own pain when I make mistakes and understand my feelings and their feelings better. I'm better friends with my slippery, clever defenses and resistances, although I still have a long way to go, and can rest better with uncertainty, anger, or that which my mind thinks is unfair or not logical. I then also marvel when I lose my way and stumble. I remember walking in a stream in Borneo with a Dayak woman in front of me who was able to step barefoot across the stones in the stream, which was a common way to get upriver. And I would follow her very painfully, and then for a moment, I could get the flow, and I'd think, I was so proud of myself that I didn't call it present, but being able to feel the stones with my feet. And then seconds later, gone. And I find that with practice too. You know, there's that moment of, I'm here, and then once I say I'm here, it's gone. But the beauty of that, I think, is, it's, besides the fact that it's humbling, is that it also reminds me of beginner's mind. And it allows me, I think it's a built-in check to our practice. And it reminds me to look to all of you and to Sangha members who are my anchor to trust the practice, and you inspire me. And as I said at the beginning, your presence and warm hearts are what remind me that this is worthwhile to keep trying over and over again. You know all what this is about far better than I, and I will admit, I want to be like you guys. The people I see practicing, as much as anything that I've mentioned so far, just, and your individuality and how you express this common practice also drive me forward. So why take the vows of a priest? Besides having an entrenched fixation on what to do next and feeling that I need to achieve, that first teacher's simple instruction opened up a way of living that feels right and has the potential for deepening my feeling of life, my aliveness. I could be very honest and tell you that I'm greedy for enlightenment, that I truly want to be wise, that I want to understand the secrets of the universe, or that I cherish our traditions, or that I'm retiring in the next couple of years. All of those things are true. Becoming a priest feels like a natural maturing and taking responsibility, taking on more challenge. Just feels right. And very much like Anne, I also looked at the the Norman's website when there was still the guidance for priests, and I started methodically reading through all of those readings about 10 years ago. Just felt like the thing to do. I also believe that commitment comes with its own magic, as that unfortunately overused quote that's often attributed to Goethe, but is from the Himalayan climber W.H. Murray, has infamously said, "The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too." Yeah, and I've found that in my life, especially in being a mother. But the real ground is more of a yearning. You know, it's something that one can't truly explain. My intuition trusts that this is right and propels me forward without me understanding it, and despite my fears and reservations and cold, sweaty palms. It's a feeling that the 4th and 5th century Chinese poet Tao Yuanming captured when he wrote, "Such a brief time we have as living forms. Why shouldn't we follow what the heart asks for?" Thank you to each of you for your support.
Stephanie Ann Shufi Goldberg. Myoan Taishin, wondrous sound, constant heart. Shufi was born and raised in Las Vegas into a family of what she called traditionally practicing Montreal Jews. Must be a special kind, Montreal, yes. She studied poetry in college before switching to philosophy. Ended up getting a degree at the New School in Philosophy and an MFA in Experimental Music and Sound Art at Bard College. She lived and worked as an artist in New York City for 21 years and now lives in Detroit, where she first lived in a Korean Zen center. Shufi and her husband Morgan, who's here with us today, now own and are restoring what was an abandoned building, and have created the Huckleberry Explorers Club, a museum installation, a life project, which is also a gathering space and a 1-acre public garden. And she's been practicing with Everyday Zen since the 2020 pandemic. Welcome, Shufi. Oh, right, sorry.
Thank you, Sean. Hi. I wanted to give a special hello to all of the people who are online tonight, and to Jeff, who is helping to take care of the online Sangha. In the 6 years that I've been practicing with Everyday Zen, this is only the second time that I've actually attended a seminar in person. It's really a miracle that we can all be here together. And I wanted to dedicate this little talk to my husband, Morgan, who, as Sean said, is here. Morgan's been with me all the way. We met when I was 20. And also my dear friend, Sam, who came here all the way from Sri Lanka to be here for the ordination. Somehow I found this talk difficult to write. Over the last 2 years, as I've prepared for ordination, people have often asked me why I decided to become a priest, why I'm practicing Zen Buddhism at all. I've been keeping a journal of my reflections and feelings and dreams about ordination, and one day I wrote down the question, why am I becoming a priest? I thought about it for a while, and then below the question, in all caps, I wrote three simple words. I don't know. I'm not really sure I have the words for the tremendous feeling I have for our Zen practice. How to express my most heartfelt desire to be of service to this Sangha that I love so much. That has supported me and inspired me. Why I was so mesmerized by Ruth Ozeki's freshly bald head in the middle of her Zoom square when she received Dharma transmission a few years ago. On the first day of Sesshin this past May, as I was looking out into the ocean, Pearl came up to me and asked, "How are you feeling, Shufi?" I said, "I feel really happy that I'm going to be a priest." I had so much gratitude bursting out of me that it felt just wonderful to have some sort of way to express it. Some container for my deep love of this crazy, mixed-up world of ours, some manifestation of my sincerest wish to dive utterly and completely into the fire of suffering and joy with all beings. When I first started sewing my okesa, I had this very strong feeling of wading into a beginningless, endless stream of practice, felt how everything in my whole life has been, little by little, creating this ordination. Everything in my parents' lives and their parents' lives, every person each of us has ever met, every chance encounter, paths taken this way and not that way, stones picked up and put in pockets, weather weathered, every bit of our suffering and each one of our joys, all Buddhas and ancestors. In other words, infinite numbers of causes and conditions had to be exactly as they were and are to make this Shufi-shaped priest before you. I am just truly in awe of all of it. During the part of the ceremony when we were asked to hug our family members, I wished I could have also hugged every person and thing and circumstance I have ever come across. I'm not sure if you can hug a circumstance, but I think it seems appropriate to try. In other words, I guess I feel that this practice chose me as much as I chose it. The practice and I encountered each other, and we made a priest. Some months ago, Kathy told me that when we ordain, there is no separation between ourselves and being a priest. That when we are priests all the time in everything we do. And I think this is something that I have always longed for, a life with no boundary, between my so-called spiritual life and my so-called secular life. I guess this is how I experience the phrase everyday Zen, not only as a simple, colloquial, unpretentious Zen that we practice outside a monastery right here in our daily lives, though that too, but a Zen that pervades everything, everywhere, that is in everything and is everything, in every moment, every day. In the winter of 2022, some of you might remember this, my neighbor, Dwayne, who lived across the street from me and my husband in Detroit, was shot and killed while sleeping in his car. Dwayne had been living in a condemned house that didn't have any utilities, and he could only get heat in his car. For about a year or so, his house sat vacant. Every once in a while, when I found the courage, I would go over to it and walk around. One day, I brought a pair of scissors with me and cut a little bit of an old bedsheet that Dwayne had used to cover a window that was now broken. When I started sewing, I had the idea to sew this piece of fabric into my zagu, my bowing mat. And a few months ago, Anne lovingly pinned it into my teko. And now, every time I wear my robes and fall on my knees and face, I feel I will be bowing to Dwayne, bowing to my city, to the bedsheet that adorned the window, to the city workers who eventually tore down his house, to the great sky witnessing us all and breathing us all. I have a very special feeling for my zagu now. Besides helping to keep my okesa tidy, it will be a lighthouse for me whenever I am lost in the fog of myself, whenever I start to feel a separation between my practice and my life, pointing me toward my primary purpose of unconditional love. As Anne also read on our new rakasus, Norman gave all of us this line from Dogen, "Let my priest's body be a raft to carry others across." When I read that, I thought, well, maybe I myself can be a zagu, helping to care for others, even if it means getting dirty sometimes in the process. I don't know exactly how being a priest is going to manifest in my daily life, and I don't really understand why or how Zen and I encountered each other in the way we did. I am very sure that any ideas I have about being a priest are about to be quickly undone. I do know that I trust this practice completely. I trust the profound simplicity of Zazen, the beauty and sadness of impermanence, the stupendous teaching that there is no separation at all between suchness and this Saha world, just the dance of all things bound together and breathing together. I trust my longing to live in the way of this great and majestic and impossible vow to fail again and fail better. I guess for me, commitment is its own result, its own beginning and end. Just jump in and say, yes, I will, and see what happens. So maybe the seemingly closed door of I don't know is a gate waiting for me to enter it. In the meantime, I'll just keep putting on my robes and sitting every day, lighting incense, caring for my garden, writing an occasional poem, dancing around my kitchen, giving and receiving hugs. My priest's body, a raft a zagu, a pitchfork, a pen, a dance, bowing, bowing, bowing. So thank you for listening to me and for everything that you've given to me. I'm infinitely grateful to all of you. And I as well am going to end with a poem. It's one that I wrote. You, eternity, writing on my hair, standing on my hair. Without me, you are, but are not manifest. Without you, I am. Variations of light. Thank you.
Denise Newman, Myōgen Genshin, inconceivable presence, profound intimacy. Denise is also a poet. She's a translator as well. Her writing, her video work, collaborative projects, she says, are guided by questions that blur the boundaries between the personal and social and explore gaps between perception, language, and reality. She's the author of 6 books of her own poetry, plus books of translation by 3 generations of experimental Danish women writers, Inger Christensen, Nadja Marie Out, and Signe Jessing. She's been teaching at California College of the Arts since 2000. She was ordained Jukai in 1999 by Paul Haller, just before marrying Stephen. And they too met in love and fell in love at San Francisco Zen Center, where they were both residents in the late 1990s. Denise, it's really wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much. Please come.
Listening to all of those beautiful talks, I really felt what Jean quoted from the ordination ceremony of all the infinite number of causes and conditions to make this possible. How lucky I am to ordain with such beautiful people in this Sangha. Norman. So I was first drawn to the Dharma through poetry. In grad school, I chose to do a class presentation on the work of Leslie Scalapino, a Buddhist and a dear friend of Norman and Sue, right? And so researching her poetry, I learned about dependent co-arising. Mm-hmm. And it really struck a chord. I think maybe because when I was a teenager, I had an experience walking in the woods in New Jersey of suddenly seeing all the many connections between everything. The tree connected to the earth connected to the leaves, the sky connected to the earth, the birth. And I just began chanting this in rhythm with my steps. And it was a really tremendous experience, and I was filled with energy that lasted for days. It was probably a release from my very punitive connection to religion through Catholicism. I was a devout Catholic, but I was also really afraid of so much. So since then, I've continued to draw inspiration from the Dharma, in particular Dogen's Shobo Genzo. Really, the only book in my life that I've had such an intense and sustained relationship with for, you know, almost two decades. I've also been very inspired by Norman's Dharma talks and his poetry. And studying koans with Reb Anderson. These are all very important facets of my relationship to the Dharma. But until maybe a few years ago, I've been a very reluctant meditator. I felt poetry was my expression of the Dharma. And I'd start the day reading Dogen, copying lines down, and then seeing where they'd take me. I'd write something down like, life and death is the real human body. And then I would just keep writing. So there's always this tether in my writing to the Dharma and to practice. And I considered my writing my practice, and I fiercely protected it. Norman, I don't think, agreed that the writing is a practice in itself. But I stuck by it. Of course, I meditated, but I felt like my true expression was in my writing. And I tried to reflect the Dharma in what I wrote about and in the forms and the way I use language. But then in 2024, May, around that time, I started to feel like maybe poetry has taken me as far as it could. My daughter had graduated college. She didn't need me as much. I wanted to intensify my practice. I wanted to be pushed. So I was in Dokusan with Norman, and just like Pearl, the words just kind of flew out of my mouth. And I remember my hand, and I said, you know, I'd consider ordaining if you thought that was appropriate. And he thought a moment, and then he said, yes, I think it is. And I think the rightness of this decision at this time in my life was confirmed by this tremendous energy I felt. I remember telling somebody, it feels kind of like falling in love. But of course, a few months later, everything changed with our accident. Everything changed. And it's still quite raw. Today is the year and a half anniversary. And part of me does not believe that Eva's gone. I just think, where are you? I dream often of her, and I ask her in the dream, when are you coming home? And she looks at me with such compassion. You know, we got a list of everything she wanted to do at 22 after she died. And one of the things on it was that she might want to be a priest one day. And so I feel strongly that I am ordaining, I have ordained, with and for Eva. In the aftermath of the accident, for many weeks, I was in shock, and I couldn't even cry. I was just trying to stay alive. I didn't have the strength to break down, and my brain was just too muddled to read the Dharma or anything else. But I could be present, I found. This was huge. I could meet each person that entered my room, and in the hospital and rehab, I was shown such kindness. Immediately, people huddled together around us as if they were trying to hold our shattered parts together. The love was overwhelming. It was almost too much. We received cards, gifts, food, visits, physical aid. So many people. Eva's friends, our friends, family, strangers. And it was impossible to thank each person. And that was hard. We're taught that, right? But I came to trust that there was no difference between giving and receiving. Everyone seemed to understand beyond words that there's only this makeshift scaffolding that separates us from each other and that separates us from between life and death. And so receiving their gifts was a way of helping them cope with the sorrow they felt for what had happened to us. So right now, I would say it's the Sangha's expression of the Dharma that's most compelling to me. And this was once again on full display during the ordination. I'd also say that the implications of being a priest are much vaster than I had realized. Because we're doing this together in real time. So any ideas about it are bound to be limited. There's nothing to control, and there's nothing to predict. I want to thank you for holding us with us the burden of our tragedy, all of you. At the end of Sesshin, when, without hesitation, everyone howled with me. I felt the power of collective grieving and the one body of our Sangha, which is the power of ritual. As a priest, I really hope that I can facilitate such experiences for people. Thank you all.
You too. Each and every new priest, new person, old person, it's a moment of auspicious opening, I think, for all of us to have five people at the same time take this vow and walk into the I don't know with all of us, which is really where we all are. And I think we all will be able to be buoyed by what we heard tonight, be inspired to reach out and feel that connection, the one in the body that was spoken of often in the presence of just the listening, the slowing down, the way we can be with each other without really saying much of anything. Except, I'm here, you're here, we're together. So, there is not time, I'm sorry, to bring up what I thought we would have time for, but we would have missed the richness of those talks, and I'm so grateful that people spent time and energy and poured their beauty into each one. So. Let us chant for our friends before we, at the end of our time together, celebrate the birthday of Denise Newman.
Recording stopped.